You're listening to the Sunrise Community Church Podcast. At Sunrise, we desire that the glory of God would be the glory of this city. If you would like more information about our church, please visit our website at sunrisecc.com. Let's join this week's message.
So it's very appropriate at times to speak about life in the mundane.
Because real life does happen in the mundane of the ebb and flow of the ho-hum of daily life. And we talk about the ordinary and the glory of the ordinary and how God meets us there. But it's also appropriate, especially as we come to passages like this before us today, to speak about the milestone moments. As we look back on life, we probably don't remember much about the mundane ho-hum moments of all of our years that we've experienced in life, but we do remember the milestones. Perhaps you remember the first time you rode a bike, the first time you fell off that bike and then tried again, the first time you drove a car. Remember what that felt like? When mom and dad weren't in the seat or whoever taught you and you were just like, I remember for me, I was like, I should not be allowed to be doing this. And sure enough, police officer followed me home a few hours later. That's another story for another time. Perhaps you remember, for those of you who've had one, your wedding day and the nerves that were present there, but then how they washed away when you saw that back door open or you saw your bride turn the corner. Perhaps you remember the births of your children, graduations, and on and on and on and on. The milestone moments that not only so often make us who we are, but these are the moments that reorient, redirect, that help us reinterpret our purpose in life and dramatically transform our direction in life. Well, we've arrived at such a moment for Jacob. In Genesis chapter 28, verse 10 to 22, Jacob goes out on a journey only to be interrupted by God, who then gives Jacob a dream where he sees a ladder in the heavens extending all the way down to earth. The destination of Jacob's journey would not change, but the man, Jacob himself, would never be the same after this moment. Perhaps today, in our own lingering through this text, it might just be a milestone moment for you in your life as the Lord grabs hold of you through his word. So we're looking at verse 10 to 22. We have a smaller portion, and so we can really dig in deep with a shovel and not so much a rake. So there's only two headings today to see, the dream and the response. So first, in verse 10 to 15, see the dream. Jacob left Beersheba and went toward Haran, and he came to a certain place and stayed there that night because the sun had set. Taking one of the stones of the place, he put it under his head and lay down in that place to sleep. And he dreamed, and behold, there was a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven. And behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. And behold, the Lord stood above it and said, I am the Lord, the God of Abraham, your father, and the God of Isaac. The land on which you lie, I will give to you and to your offspring. Your offspring shall be like the dust of the earth. And you shall spread abroad to the west and to the east and to the north and to the south. And in you and your offspring shall all the families of the earth be blessed. Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go and will bring you back to this land. For I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. Our passage begins today with a reminder of what we saw last week in the large chunk of text before us. There we saw the outcome of Rebekah and Jacob's deception as Jacob stole the blessing meant for his older brother Esau. For this, Jacob would have to leave home for his own safety because of Esau's fury. He desired to kill him. And so in verse 10 here in our text today, we see Jacob leave. Remember, though, this certainly had to be a bitter departure. Jacob was not like Esau. He was not the man's man, the man of the wilderness, the man skilled in navigating out in the countryside, living off game he hunted, the favorite of his father. This was not Jacob. That was Esau. Jacob, for likely his whole life, enjoyed home. Extremely comfortable in his domestic setting, not having calluses on his hands, dirt under his fingernails, the favorite of his mother. Yet now, because of his own deception, he had to turn away from all he knew and head off on his own. The bitterness of this departure was not only in leaving mom behind, but the bitterness was that he was going into the wilderness for a journey to Laban, his uncle's house. He did not know his way around the wilderness. He did not know how to hunt game, likely, to provide for himself. He did not know, likely, or had never before set up a campsite where he would then have to protect himself all night from animals that would seek to ravage him. Nevertheless, off he goes. And in this whole journey, it was a long journey. In the text itself, I wonder if you noticed this. This is the only moment of this whole journey we get recorded. Right here, this dream that he has where he's sleeping on the rock. That's peculiar, right? We'll talk about that. But this is the only moment of this whole entire journey that we get to witness. When we start chapter 29, he's right there near Laban's house. So the only little bitty episode of this whole journey we get is the dream. Why is that the case? Well, maybe it's easy to answer. I think it is. This is the moment that dramatically changes Jacob's life. He would never be the same after meeting God here. So out of this whole journey, we get to see the moment that he would never forget. Well, he leaves in verse 10, and in verse 11, we see him come, it says, to a certain place. We'll learn more about the name of this place later on in our passage. For now, just notice that it seems that he's forced to sleep outside under the stars. It's as if he just left and went out in a general heading, like, where's Laban's house? That way. And so off that way he goes. And he didn't know how to navigate, didn't know how to take care of himself, didn't know how to keep going in the right direction. It just got to the point where the sun's going down. He knows, okay, I need to sleep. And so he just lays down. Rock for a pillow and all. Do you wonder what's going on through his head in this moment? I mean, isn't it the case that when our heads hit the pillow, whatever we're using for a pillow, that our truest, deepest, and sometimes darkest thoughts start playing on repeat? I mean, some people, when they sleep, I've heard their favorite songs, like the Beach Boys' Greatest Hits, just starts playing, and they just they soothe into sleep. But for most of us, I'd say the album that plays is 50 Greatest Mistakes. After all he's been through, and knowing where he now is, you have to wonder how he's doing. Back home is an angry brother, a grieving mother, a confused father. And he didn't know it yet, but before him lies an uncle that is more deceptive than him. And he had been blessed as he went out, immensely blessed. This is the blessing of Isaac, the blessing of Abraham coming down to him, that he will be great, that he will be made into a nation, that he will inherit all this land, that he will have a ton of descendants, and that by being blessed in this land, he and his descendants will become a blessing to the whole earth. Yet here he is, no wife, no children. Abraham first received this promise as he's coming into the land. Jacob receives this promise right before he has to flee the land. It really does seem like he's in a mess of his own making. He legitimately might be wondering, how are all these wonderful blessings going to come true in my life? Look where I am. This is the great context for the great moment that we're about to witness. In this state of soul, Jacob eventually is able to find sleep, and when he is asleep, he dreams. There are four elements to this dream. We can take a slow pace through them, so let's do that. First, notice the description in verse 12. And he dreamed, and behold, there was a ladder set up on the earth, and the top of it reached to heaven. And behold, the angels of God were ascending and descending on it. This is Jacob's ladder, so-called, because it's his dream. The ladder now comes into view. The Hebrew word for ladder is salam. It's the only time in the whole entire Old Testament that it occurs. And so it's difficult to know kind of where this word comes from, how it's used in other contexts, how it's being employed here. There are other translations that are possible other than ladder, staircase, flight of steps, perhaps think something of like a Mayan temple. There's steps leading up to the top where the deity would be. Ziggurat, I think, is a technical term for it. That might be what's in view here, what he's seeing. But whatever is in view, we get the sense of what's happening in his dream. A ladder comes down from the entrance of heaven all the way to where he is on earth. That's the description. Second, notice the angels. On this ladder that connects heaven and earth, Jacob sees the angels of God, the messengers of God, ascending and descending the ladder. This is not a display of angelic activity in raw form, as if this is what Jacob is seeing angels for all eternity doing, just going up and down. Up and down, up and down. I think what's in view here, Jacob is witnessing how the angelic host actually functions with the Lord. He's at the top of it, that's our third thing to notice in just a minute. But he is sending them out with specific work to do in this general region or for that specific task. And then once that's done, they go back up for further instruction. I think that's what's going on. And so naturally, other verses then speak of this kind of activity. Psalm 91, verse 11. God will command his angels concerning you to guard you in all your ways. Or Hebrews chapter 1, verse 14, it speaks about angels and says, are they not all ministering spirits sent out to serve for the sake of those who are to inherit salvation? So I think the picture we see is that God commands and sends out his angels to guard and serve all those who believe. Now, I'm aware that there are some who interpret passages like this and the ones I read that the Bible teaches the idea that there are guardian angels. I don't think this is true. Rather, to use a sports analogy, perhaps, I don't think angels play man-on-man defense. As if one angel is just assigned one human being. Rather, I think what we see here in pictures like this is there's a zone defense from the angelic host for all the people of God for all time. I think that's more of a biblical picture, if that doesn't help, just forget that. Just guardian angels, no. Well, as these angels get sent out from God, their protective work is being done, and then they return to the Lord for further directions. That's the second thing to see, the angels. Third, notice the Lord. As verse 13 begins, we see that at the top of the ladder is the Lord himself. And that he's in this position teaches us so much. The Lord is the sovereign king over all. There is no one above him. He is at the top. There's no one above him. All else is below him, and therefore all things serve him, and his will governs everything. But also held within this idea and this picture we see of the Lord on top is another truth. If there is to be a connection between heaven and earth, if there's to be a communication given from God to man, if God is to reveal himself to man, if man wants to know who God is, God has to be the one to initiate it. He has to be the one to open the heavens and send the ladder down. Jacob cannot build this ladder to the top. We've already seen a tale like that in Genesis chapter 11, the tale of the tower at Babel. God had to come down from where he was to even be able to see it. And then he stopped them, confused them, and scattered them in their prideful, vainglorious attempts to make themselves a name. So, though this is historically, and I've even titled the sermon Jacob's Ladder, it's God's ladder. This is God's ladder. It's not Jacob's. He just sees it. Fourth and lastly, notice the language that is used. It is hard to miss. Like, you have to do gymnastics to get around the covenantal overtones of the language that God uses in verse 13 and 14. There were hints of this in the previous chapter with the stolen blessing, that Abraham's covenant promises passed to Isaac, and then Isaac, in blessing Jacob, gives him some of the promises. But now it is crystal clear and plain for us to see in verse 13 and 14 as it repeats the blessing of God, the blessing of the promise of the land, the promise of great descendants, that his descendants will fill the earth, that through his descendants all of the earth will be blessed, and that he will be a blessing. How encouraging would this have been to him? That despite his current circumstances and having to leave the land due to his own sin, God will see to it that he will not only come back to the land, but he will bless him so much that he will flourish in the land. Then, if it could not get any more encouraging, we hear verse 15, which might need to be on your bathroom mirror or your dashboard, right? Not to cover up important gauges, but to be reminded of what God is for us. Behold, I am with you and will keep you wherever you go and will bring you back to this land, for I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. How surprising to hear God interrupt Jacob's journey and sleep with this amount of grace. Jacob might have legitimately believed that if God were to interrupt him in his journey, he's not coming with grace, but he's coming with judgment and a sword. Did he not just blaspheme God's name and lying to his father? How did you get that food so quick, my son? The Lord blessed me and gave it to me very quickly. And now here, that God shows up, not in judgment, but with grace. Jacob was not looking for God. Jacob did not seek God. Jacob did not invite God to meet him. Jacob was on the run because of his sin, scared and distraught, yet into his sinful plight came the Lord. And upon being interrupted, there is no rebuke, no wrath, no anger, just a stream of divine assurances that would have reoriented, redirected, transformed his entire life and what it was to be about from this point on. Wherever Jacob's life takes him, God will be with him, and the promises of God will remain true. Well, that's the dream, the great moment. Let's keep on and see what Jacob does in response to this. That's in verse 16 to 22. Let's break this one up. In verse 16 and 17, we see awe, A-W-E, awe. And then second, we see a vow, his vow. In verse 18 to 22, his awe, his vow. This is his response. Let's look at the awe first. Verse 16 and 17. Then Jacob awoke from his sleep and said, "Surely the Lord is in this place, and I did not know it." And he was afraid. He said, "How awesome is this place? This is none other than the house of God, and this is the gate of heaven." Clearly, the dream, understatement of the year, made a large impact on Jacob. Clearly, it impacted him. Little did he know that the place, the unknown place where he just laid down to sleep because he ran out of light, ran out of energy to keep going, would be the very place that God would meet him in grace. So upon waking up, he has beautiful words to say. Beautiful words to say, full of gravity and full of gladness as Jacob becomes aware that he's in the Lord's very presence. And then he confesses that this is none other than the house of God, the gate of heaven. And for these reasons, this place is awesome. It's awesome that this place is awesome. How glorious is it to see that the darkness and isolation of his scary, fearful night wonderfully transforms into a worshipful morning. It's hard to find words to describe how monumental of a moment this is for Jacob. He knew of his parents' faith in the Lord. He knew of the covenant promises. He's heard of them. He's been taught these things, but up until this point in his life, he has never really personally encountered the Lord himself until now. And now he does, and he will forever be different. He's as trembly fearful as he is wonderfully ecstatic. That's his awe. But look now at his vow, verse 18 to 22. So early in the morning, Jacob took the stone that he put under his head and set it up for a pillar and poured oil on top of it. He called the name of that place Bethel, but the name of the city was Luz at first. Then Jacob made a vow. It's curious, just information for you. This is the first time in the Bible up to this point that a vow occurs. And it's the only time one of the patriarchs will make a vow, and it's the longest vow in the entire Old Testament. Normally a vow is like a phrase. This I will do. Jacob gives verses here about what he will do. He says, notice, if God will be with me, and will keep me in this way that I go, and will give me bread to eat and clothing to wear, so that I come again to my father's house in peace, then the Lord shall be my God. And this stone which I have set up for a pillar shall be God's house. And of all that you give me, I will give a full tenth to you. So Jacob's awe in the Lord produces in him a deep desire to commit his life to the Lord. As Abraham did long before him, Jacob now grabs what was the pillow and turns it into the pillar. The pillow becomes the pillar, and he pours oil on it. This is worshiping according to the customs of his age. That's okay, right? There are things that are the same from age to age to age with the worship of God's people, and there are ways it is different from age to age to age. This is what it was like then. He calls this place Bethel, Beit El, which means the house of God. It was formerly called Luz. This is of significance. Luz was the general region that he was in, which part of it was a big pagan city. That's clearly not where Jacob is. He's way outside the city. He doesn't know at this point. He just went off in a direction until he lost the light. But it's interesting, God did not meet him in the city. He did not meet him where it was popular to be, prominent to be. God met him out in the isolation of the wilderness, in the dark and scary night. What was nothing out there, God turned into something. What was just a place, as we saw this text begin in verse 11, now becomes the very house of God. And how like God to take what seems to be nothing and make it something. Something that will last for all eternity. His very house. But you see his vow? This is one I'd not recommend you to make. It's a little bit too conditional for our tastes, right? What do we make about this? Is it a good one or is it a bad one? Well, it honestly depends who you read on this text, what kind of study Bible you have. Some will give a very favorable opinion of this. Some will give a very negative opinion of this. And I just want to say both are true at the same time. How can that be? On one hand, this really is not what we'd like to see in Jacob. We'd like to see a wholehearted commitment and devotion to the Lord. It's not conditional. It doesn't say, if you do these things for me and make sure that my life is comfortable like I've always lived, being having everything I've needed, clothes and food and shelter over my head, if you continue to do that for me and never put me at a place where I'm uncomfortable and inconvenienced, then you'll be God to me and I will worship you. Clearly, the boy is still the boy in this vow. This is a conditional if-then kind of commitment to God. And in that sense, this is not what we'd like to see from him. But on the other hand, I think it's honest. I think it's honest. It reflects Jacob as he is in this very moment. He has so much to learn. He's just met the Lord. What else do you expect from a baby believer? He's just met him. He doesn't know any different. He has much to learn. And we know in the coming chapters, God will teach him much. But see it, church. Jacob left home a sinful runaway, and now he leaves Bethel, this place, committed to the Lord, living under his promises, pledging to no longer be a deceiver and taker. But notice, of all he has, a tenth he will give, the deceiver has become a giver. Giving us the pattern of what we talked about earlier and an offering. This ought to be normal for Christians to give a tithe and an offering. It's not just for mature Christians, it's for all Christians, baby believers and all. The response is devotion to God and a giving up of our time, talents, and treasure, offering it to the Lord for Him to use for His purposes. Well, that's the text. And words fail, but we'll try to describe how we can glean from this glorious moment. There are thousands of things we could talk about, but let's just summarize real quick. Let's summarize the glory and irony of this. A man running away from home runs into God. A man fearing his brother encounters a more fearful God. An unknown place becomes God's place. A rock becomes a temple. A guilty sinner wakes up an eager worshiper, and a taker becomes a giver. This is what conversion looks like. What does it look like to become a Christian? It looks like this. It looks like transformation. It looks like a new direction. It looks like the same person, same personality, but all of a sudden a new posture about all of life, as imperfect as it's going to be. So here are four takeaways for us on this. And we're going to use Jacob's experience to kind of mesh with our own here. First, as Jacob was, so are we. What do I mean by that? Well, Jacob was sinful, guilty, deceptive, fearful, heavy laden with burdens of his own making. Is this what you know yourself to be? Or do you suppress this and fight this down and think, no, I've got what it takes to make it in this world? I pray that you know yourself to be this, because this is the only way to true recovery of soul. It's the only way to become a healthy, this is how you flourish as a human being. You own that you're not what you ought to be. You embrace it and you bring it to the Lord. As Jacob was, so are we. Second, as God was with Jacob, so too the Lord is with us. Beauty upon beauty. This is like the crescendo moment in the song, the play, the drama. God met Jacob in his sin when Jacob was not looking for him. It wasn't even on his radar. Have any of you heard of the theologian A.W. Pink? He has wonderful initials, I must say. He describes this moment so beautifully when he says this: right down to where the fugitive lay, the ladder came, and right up to God himself, the ladder reached. Church, this is our God. This is how God saves. This is how God interrupts. And so if any of you are ashamed of your past, if you are hiding, if you're disgraced in your own soul about things you've done in the past, things you've left undone in the past, if you're paralyzed at the present moment or have been because your sin just looks like an Everest that's too tall to climb, this is where you go. Right here. Nothing is too hard for the Lord. God is able to meet you where you are. He did it with Jacob here. He can do it for you today. If you turn to Him, see it, He will come be with you. He will bless you and remain with you forever. Third, as Jacob responded to the Lord, so ought we. Verse 16 to 22 is real. Like, this is not just like flowery Bible language, like made for children's Sunday school. Like, oh, he's interrupted by the ladder and he says, how awesome is this place? Surely this is the Lord's presence. This is real. Jacob was sobered with fear and awe in the presence of God, and he loved it. From such awe, he devoted himself to God. Imperfectly, yes, but he will grow in time. He will grow. This pattern ought to be true in us as well. If we've truly come to the Lord, or if the Lord has truly come to us, we will devote ourselves to him in response. It will not be something that someone's got to yank your arm to do. You'll want to do it. If you've come to the Lord, you will not only be sobered with fear and awe in his presence, you'll want to live for him all your days. We will pledge ourselves to him and give all we have to him, offerings of time, of talent, of treasure. But remember, our faith and our obedience and our devotion and our commitment to the Lord to live for him will be imperfect. We don't talk about this enough, perhaps, but have you ever realized that that's the only kind of faith that exists, is an imperfect faith? Because the only kind of person that exists is imperfect people. One broke the mold, and he is our hope. All the rest of us have an imperfect faith, but God will grow us in time, will teach us better things, will show us a better way, enlarge our view of him, deepen our worship of him, sober us with more gravity, gladden us with more joy and delight in him. Do not expect mature things from baby believers. I expect them from mature believers. And you ought to as well. In time, God will grow us and do all that is pleasing to him in us. So as Jacob was, so are we. As God was with Jacob, so too the Lord is with us. And as Jacob responded to the Lord, so ought we respond to the Lord as well. Fourth and finally, as this was the gate of heaven for Jacob, so too is Jesus Christ for us. At the end of, perhaps some of you know it, at the end of the first chapter of John's Gospel, Jesus calls Philip and Nathanael to himself, and Nathanael has a wonderful childlike moment to see. He's just befuddled wonderfully that Jesus could see him in the tree when he was way off in the distance. And he responds, Nathanael, saying to Jesus after he realizes what he actually could do, he says, Rabbi, you are the Son of God. You are the King of Israel. You know what Jesus says to him? John 1:51. He says this, truly, truly, I say to you, you will see heaven opened and the angels of God ascending and descending on the Son of Man. Do you see what he just said? The fancy word for this is typology. But Jesus reaches back to this moment in Genesis and tells Nathanael, and John, the author of his gospel, really wants us to know because he recorded it for us. Out of all the things he could have recorded, we got this. He really wants us to know Jesus is the ladder. He's the ladder. What does that mean? It means Jesus is the connection between heaven and earth. It means that Jesus is the way, the truth, the life. It means that Jesus is the only mediator given by God to man by which we must be saved, the only mediator between God and man to bring them back together. It means that Jesus alone meets us in our sin and remakes us in his image. But for Jacob, this was just a dream. For us, it's reality. Because at the time that God had appointed, God literally came down. And so the ladder is such a fitting image for what Jesus is for us, because he's not only on top of it being the King of Kings, but he came down also to dwell with us. He's at the top of it. He's at the bottom of it. Everything that we need to come back to God is found in Jesus. People will try to sell you a bill of goods saying the greatest clue to vibrant vitality and spiritual living is this little thing that I've just discovered. To say anything new about spirituality is really to say you're an old kind of heretic. That's what they've all been saying for ages and ages. Jesus is the centerpiece. He's the ladder, the focus, the center of our faith. He is the one that stirs up our obedience, that stirs up our glad-hearted devotion, that stirs up our gravity-sobering awe and majesty. He is the one that we must be fixed upon. If you feel dry, if you feel far away, if you feel soaring on the heights of praise, Jesus is the one to right everything wrong in us and the world. He is the secret and always must be the secret. There's no other thing for us than Jesus. And upon seeing him, we must say, Jesus is the new and greater Bethel, where man now meets God. Surely, the Lord is in this place. How awesome is this place?
Thank you for listening to the Sunrise Community Church Podcast. We pray you are blessed by the preaching of God's Word. If you would like more information about our church, please visit our website at sunrisecc.com. May the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, the love of God, and the fellowship of the Holy Spirit be with you all.